everyone. Welcome to the Hop Ons podcast. If you hear lips smacking, that's because we're eating some ice cream sandwiches as we record today while we're talking about season one, episode two, Top Banana.
Yes. Yeah.
John, how are you today?
I'm great, man. I'm a lot better now. I'm eating this ice cream sandwich.
Are you happy I talked you into this?
I don't know how much of talking you did. You just said, hey, you want an ice cream sandwich?
Will you stop throwing your phone on the table
That? I forgot we were recording.
So
anyway,
so we're eating ice cream sandwiches while we're talking about this episode, mm-hmm. because that's one of the gags in the episode.
The very beginning.
It's the ice cream sandwich. Yeah. And it's used as a framing device, really, in this episode at the beginning and then at the end. But a little bit of information about this episode.
Don't let it melt. OK,
it's fine.
All right. Go ahead.
So Top Banana, November 9th, 2003. So we're still on Sundays. And this mm-hmm. is something we'll track because a criticism people have made of not the show, but Fox, really, they didn't give it a consistent day and time slot, which is why it couldn't find an audience.
Right.
So we're still on Sunday. We're still in the 9:30 time slot. If I said in the first episode that it was 10, I'm mistaken. They're in the 9:30 time slot. 6.7 million. But again, for a bit of context, they were competing with, you'll love this, by the way, John, they were competing with Alias, which is an hour or was an hour long show. They started at 9 o'clock and Alias 9.3 million.
What happened to Jennifer Garner before we keep going? Just what happened to her? What does she do now?
I don't know. What does she do now?
I don't know. I know she divorced Ben Affleck, right?
I don't know. Did that happen?
This is our new Hollywood Confidential podcast.
It is.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I know she made a movie about Jesus last year or this year where they showed like literally the whole plot in the trailer. Like her daughter fell out of a tree and like the doctor was played by, I don't know, some Whoopi Goldberg-esque character. And it was like, there's no way your baby should be alive. and then it like cuts to her and she's like, I wonder what happened. And then it's like shows an angel. That's the trailer. I just told you the whole movie. I don't know what the name of it was.
I remember she made 13 going on 30. Have you seen? I believe that's what it's called. Mm-hmm. It's what's that Tom Hanks movie from the 80s where he's a boy, but he just arrived.
Big.
Okay. So it was a remake of Big,
right,
but with Jennifer Garner. So
with the lady. Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. We'll save that for our Alias.
Okay.
Podcast.
Anyway. So, Alias is on, which was a big deal.
Big deal, but only 9.3 million. The two big programs, I suppose, for that night, this will surprise you. Two movies on CBS and NBC. The Elizabeth Smart Story,
right,
on CBS, 16 million viewers. And Saving Jessica Lynch on NBC, 14.9.
Are those like the same kind of thing?
I have no idea. I didn't check.
I don't know either.
I didn't check.
I don't either.
But an additional bit of context. Earlier in the evening, The Simpsons, they had an hour block, about 12 million. And in the 9 o'clock time slot, Malcolm in the Middle, 9.6.
Right.
So and this is down, by the way, from the pilot. It's down, I believe, by well over a million viewers.
I was going to say, yeah, substantial. Yeah.
Because I think they were at 8 million for the first episode.
I'll read the plot summary while you take a bite of your ice cream.
Right. Okay. Well, written by Mitch Hurwitz.
And Russo brothers directed it.
Russo. Only Anthony Russo.
One of the Russos.
One of the other Russo was off, I don't know, persuading Marvel to let him make awesome movies or something.
I need to make all your movies.
I know. So here's the IMDb plot summary. You go ahead. I am taking a bite of this delicious ice cream sandwich.
Okay. Here we go. Michael suspects that George Sr. is running the business from inside prison. George Michael is made manager of the banana stand, Mr. Manager. And Michael gives Job a letter to mail after Lucille suggests that he be included in the business. I can't wait to get to that part.
That's a relatively accurate plot summary.
Yes, it is.
More so than the pilot.
If you were to read that, like not knowing what the show was, though, it sounds very boring. It sounds very, very boring.
It certainly does.
But all those things are great.
You're right.
So let's get into what you liked about this episode.
Okay. A couple of things I liked. I like how the episode establishes the power dynamic and struggle between Michael and George Sr.
Yes. Yeah.
Because that is both serious, but it's also hilarious because George Sr. at one point just throws part of an ice cream sandwich at his Michael's face, which is wonderful. So I like that because it's an important theme that is addressed and returned to really throughout the series. But I also like how this episode introduces parenting as a theme in this show, because this is a show about how parents parent their children. And Michael spends a fair amount of time in season one criticizing Lindsay and Tobias for their lack of parental rigor with Maybe. Yeah. But that would seem to imply that Michael is a great parent. But this episode certainly establishes he is not as great as maybe he thinks he is, because He is incredibly overbearing. And we can see some of that anxiety manifest in George, Michael, and some of the choices He makes near the end of the episode.
Yeah, we can talk about that for a second. I think that you're absolutely correct, but I do like that at the end Michael kind of sees that and just backs off, because he sees there's a moment when we flash back to when Michael first worked at the banana stand, and he was like, I spent all my summers there, it was great. And it shows him like covered in chocolate and he's like freaking out, and then George Michael basically has the exact same experience. And I think Michael at the end, you know, because George Michael wants to burn the banana stand down when things don't go his way.
Sure.
And Michael finally just is like, yeah, let's just burn it down.
Can we talk about that cutscene for a moment? Because I have a couple of questions about it.
Sure.
So, and also near the end, faintly, you can hear George Sr. say, it's our best summer ever. Just looks like he's about ready to lose consciousness. So Michael says, you're right. He says, I used to love working in that banana stand. And then we cut to this scene where it's abundantly clear that no one would enjoy that. So what does that tell us? Is Michael lying to George Michael? Is Michael simply choosing to remember it differently? Or is Michael someone who is very masochistic and enjoys hurting himself, so he remembers it fondly? Because, I mean, this is a show, and Lindsay talks about this, that Michael likes to abuse himself in certain ways, and that's how he finds meaning and significance. Why do they cut to that? What is that meant to tell us, do you think? Oh, I think it's funny, but...
Yeah, I think he just remembers it fondly. That's what I would imagine. Okay. And I can see, like, years from now, George Michael like telling his son that same kind of story and remembering it really fondly.
Just choosing to forget all of the horrible moments.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair.
So you like the parental thing. Anything else that you really liked about this episode?
Well, Job is so dumb. And you and I talked about this before we started recording. I like this refrain throughout the show, and it's introduced in this episode. Job wants respect. He wants to be taken seriously. He wants to be the older brother. He wants to be the patriarch, but he doesn't really want that. He just wants someone to ask him. So I love that so much. That's so funny, because that probably suggests some important things about this character, that he never actually wants the thing he thinks he wants. He just wants it offered to him so he can say no, which is hilarious.
He just wants the recognition, and then he just wants to be like,
for doing nothing, because we're told with the frozen dove that
one of the fucking best gags.
We're told in voiceover that Job suspected he couldn't get the refund that he thought he was entitled to. And just Job as this entitled ass is such a funny bit of humor.
I think that we could talk about the dead dove for a second, which is one of the best jokes, the best jokes ever. I mean, when we see Michael open the freezer up and pull the brown paper bag out, and it says on it, dead dove inside, do not eat. And he opens it up and looks inside and goes, I don't know what I was expecting. Like, that itself has become this weird meme online, which I think is cool. But it also cuts to one of my favorite scenes is when Job is buying the dove and the magician hands it, or the magician store hand, or the animal store hands it to him. And he's like, the guy goes, do you need a cage? Is that what he says? And he goes, no, I'm a magician. And he just shoves it in his jacket and just runs into the door, and you hear the bird just stop talking. It is so fucking perfect in every way.
And then he asks, what is your return policy?
What's your return policy? It's just awesome.
But that's another one of those moments where the editing and this documentary crew or whomever they are, because Job says, I the bird died in one of my acts, but then it cuts to the definitely not an act, just Job being an inconsiderate idiot.
That's but awesome.
Why do you think he wrote "Don't eat on the back"? So, I mean, if we're meant to believe that
Job's an idiot. I mean, Job is that dumb where he would think there is a chance someone could like cornball this up and eat it. So I'm going to write on here, "Do not eat." That's how his brain works.
Well, plus we don't learn this in this episode. It's much later, but the Blues have been taught to leave detailed notes.
Yes, they have. And that could be a gag. I mean, yeah. there's another gag, like the Never Nude thing starts in this, but you don't really know what
it
is.
Really?
Yeah, you definitely see Tobias, which is one of my one of the best things in this episode.
Oh, you're right.
Is that Lindsay has this weird ability to get a job over Tobias, and Tobias is trying his ass off to get a job, and every time like it's brought up at how like insecure Tobias is about his masculinity, he just excuses himself and then he goes and cries in the shower. And when he's in the shower, you can see him with the blue jean shorts.
Wow, I didn't see. That's a great observation.
I don't think that I would have ever, when I first watched it, I'm sure that I never thought about that.
I didn't either.
But yeah, he's already a never knew.
I had no idea. Because you talked about in our last episode how sympathetic Tobias is.
Yes.
And it's so sad.
This is a very sad but perfect Tobias episode.
It's so sad because he's sitting on the couch on the boardwalk and
he's got the tractor pull. He finds a magazine rack and he thought it's his actor pull and he pulls in his tractor pull and he looks and there's a page that has parts at the top of it. And he's like, "Look at all these parts."
And then Michael just, and because Michael's the same way, right? He walks up. Well, I'm sure you saw that, right? It's just so easy for Michael to look at a billboard. And this speaks to his incompetence that he can't even look at a board correctly. But then he doesn't read the full script. He only reads half of it, it seems. So he thinks there's a fire and he doesn't get to the fire sale part.
Which is my favorite. We got to. Okay, so this story element is
sidebar.
Tobias, we learn in the pilot, wants to be an actor,
right?
And so in this episode, Michael comes home basically, and he finds Lindsay and Tobias on the couch where they've been all day doing nothing, just laying there. And it's one of my favorite physical jokes is when Lindsay reaches over and like taps Tobias, and after she leans her hand back, Tobias like goes to grab her hand. That's just really funny. And Job is also on another couch, and they're just all laying there doing nothing.
And then there's Maybe behind the couch.
Oh, yeah, Maybe's behind the couch.
And this is a gag they really like to do where the camera seems to establish that only two people are in the room.
Yeah.
And then it pulls back a bit, and we can see maybe there's 10 people in the room, but we would have never known that.
And Michael is saying, "Why don't you get up and find a job?" You know, and Tobias he's up, and he seems excited for a second. He's like, "I'm an actor now. I'm so happy to be an actor." And Lindsay's like, "Well, you've never even gotten a part." And he immediately just gets really sad and he runs off and starts crying. And throughout the episode, he figures out finally how to get an audition. He gets the audition. He completely ruins it because it's for an ad for a fire sale. And he thinks it's for an
it's the South.
The South, I can't remember.
Something boutique.
Boutique.
It's just a sale.
It's not anything about fire prevention.
No.
Which is what Tobias has in his mind.
Yeah.
And I think that scene is the best scene in the episode.
Really? Okay.
When Tobias just lets loose with his audition and he starts screams, "Oh my God, we're having a fire sale." And then he's like on the ground singing Amazing Grace and he's rolling around. It is so fucking funny. And then immediately after that, Lindsay just pops her head in and gets the part. And it just shows like how super insecure and terrible Tobias is at everything. And I think that's what this episode was very good at doing.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's mirrored in Job's ineptitude and how bad he is at everything.
Yeah.
Maybe's ineptitude and how bad she is at everything. We really just see a series of plot lines that converge to lead us to believe the Blues are awful at everything. Because even Lindsay, so she gets this job, but she celebrates too much, has a hangover, and doesn't actually get the job.
Yeah, she sleeps through the job.
So like Job, she receives recognition for a thing she didn't do, yeah. or the recognition seems to be all that really matters to her.
And I don't know. That is one of my favorite. Tobias is perfect in this episode, and we'll get back to him later. But I want to talk about all the amazing jokes that are in this episode, because, again, this is one of those episodes that, like the pilot, had so many jokes in it that just continue to run through. And this one has so many, I think, that are super memorable jokes. Mm-hmm. Like, the ice cream sandwich is one of the best things in the whole season. It's really funny to see George Sr. When George Sr. is in there and he's eating ice cream sandwich and he says, you know, I'm having a love affair with this ice cream sandwich. That's one of the best jokes. And T-Bone shows up. That whole prison scene is executed perfectly.
And then it's called back later when Michael goes to his mother's house and you hear her.
She goes, well, why don't you marry an ice cream sandwich? And Michael goes, were you on the phone with Dad? And she goes, no, that was Job.
I just love the idea that I like to think about what has happened from the moment when Michael left the prison and went to his mother's house.
Well, it's almost as if George Sr. got really like super butthurt about it. And he's like, I got to call her and talk about it because I'm really sad right now. And he's like, listen to what Michael did.
But it's OK because I have another ice cream sandwich. And then he just talks for 10 minutes about how much he loves the ice cream sandwiches.
That's so fucking good.
That's what I want to see. I don't want to actually see a conversation. I just want to read the script where I can see the dialogue between Lucille and George Sr. Yeah. about the ice cream sandwich.
I agree with that. That would be awesome. Yeah, speaking of which, you just let it melt.
I know.
You talked way too much and you let it melt.
I'm so sorry. I almost finished it, though. I'll take a
picture
of it.
You can't just let it lay here. You're going to have to do something with
it. Well, I'll figure it out. Let's just keep going.
Okay, anyway. So the ice cream sandwich joke, the dead dove joke.
We talked about that.
Maybe being very bad at math.
Okay, so why? Okay, so we need to talk about why maybe is even at the banana stand.
Right. So George Michael is in love with his cousin, basically. Well, he's not in love with her. He just wants to bang her, I guess.
We're not sure
we're
yet.
We're not sure.
Let's call it a juvenile infatuation.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And he wants to get away from her. So he's like, I want to work more hours at the banana stand.
And this is a great joke, too.
And so his dad's like, oh, wow, you're just like me. And then he walks in on everybody asleep or everybody laying on the couches. And at that moment, Michael decides that he is going to take control of Lindsay's daughter pretty much. And he says, maybe you're going to work with your cousin at the banana stand. You're not going to be like these people. And so George Michael's trying so hard to get away from her and now is like basically in a closet with her. All day long.
Have we talked about the Mr. Manager joke? Because
we have not talked about Mr. Manager.
So this is another moment where
another great joke.
Michael says something. George Michael repeats it, and then Michael corrects him. Yes. Which again, I don't. Why do you think Michael is so anxious about hearing George Michael say Mr. Manager?
I don't know.
What's that about? Because he seems genuinely concerned that George Michael would call himself Mr. Manager.
Do you think it's an actual, like, do you think that that is something that his character does, or do you think that's just a joke that they wanted to put in?
I don't know. Because he says, you're Mr. Manager. And then George Michael says, yes, I am Mr. Manager. And I think it's the enthusiasm. I don't know. I think you're right. It might be a character flaw where Michael says something and he doesn't get the response he wants.
Okay.
But there is nothing in what he said that would lead George Michael to answer correctly. So he says, Mr. Manager. What else would George Michael say but Mr. Manager?
Yeah, if he was like super enthused, which he is.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. So I think you're right. I think it's probably just a character flaw where Michael has an idea of what he wants someone to say to him, but he under no circumstances puts that person in a position where they could say that thing to him.
Yeah.
Because either he's not clear about what he wants or he's really obscure and opaque with what he says. I think it's just Michael being controlling.
Yeah, it's weird how I don't want to look at Michael as a villain, but he does have a lot of villain characteristics.
He does. I mean, he in a different type of show. Again, I wonder if we saw this show from Job's perspective,
right?
Michael would probably be a villain, right?
Yeah.
I think so.
What would the show look like from Job's perspective?
God, I want to see that.
It would be a very Lynchy, David Lynch style.
Probably.
30-minute, I don't know what. It would be very bizarre.
But it would probably be a show where Job just had one interaction after another and felt incredibly persecuted. That would be the show. Yeah, it would just be.
That's making me so sad.
We would just call it Persecution. That would be the name of the show. And the irony, of course, is that Job is a white man, so he's the least likely to get persecuted.
That's very, very sad.
I know it is.
There's so many jokes.
There are. There's a lot of. You're right. This is. So the pilot does what a pilot needs to do.
Yes.
But this feels like the first real Arrested Development episode.
Yeah, I agree with that. The pilot just is, here's all these characters and here's a little bit of story. And this is very, like, narrative driven.
It is.
But it's also just chock full of great lines. I mean, anytime Tobias has to leave the room and he goes, excuse me, please. And, like, he walks out. It's so funny.
This is one of my favorite lines. We'll talk about it later. In this business of show, you must have the heart of an angel and the hide of an elephant.
Of an elephant. I wrote that down too.
That's such an awesome joke. And no one seems to understand what the hell he's talking about. And this establishes this tendency Tobias has just to say something super strange. And then everyone just stares at him. Later in the season, he makes a reference to landing on all fours or always being on all fours.
Yes. <it's laughs> super, like, so much homosexual overtone.
Like a cat. There's no Buster in this episode.
I didn't notice that until you're just now saying this, but you're right. There is no Buster at all.
So you talked about in the last episode how much you like Buster. How do you feel not seeing? Because a couple of these early episodes, they are Buster free.
They're definitely not in the next. The next episode's called Buster something.
Oh, no. I didn't mean every early episode.
Oh, right.
There's maybe it's episode 4 or 5 where we're told he's in Canada getting his jaw fixed.
I wonder what he's doing. I wonder what Tony Hale was doing.
There's a couple of episodes in season 1 where there's no Buster at
that
all.
It sucks. I know. I didn't realize it until right now. But yeah, there is no Buster. I was fine with it because I think Tobias really kind of took the spotlight. And the show focused a lot on him and George Michael, who also was really perfectly very awkward and awesome. Well,
this is something I was asking you about last week, that at times it feels like Buster can be a bit too big. And you mentioned how it felt like he was competing for attention with everyone else. And I wonder if some of these episodes that are without Buster are deliberately without Buster because – Buster fit in this story? I don't, because Buster feels, I think they do a wonderful job, especially in season 2, of bringing Buster into the family dynamic in ways that feel organic.
Yes.
But Buster, and I suppose we're told in the pilot that Buster has always existed on the periphery of this family because he'll always go off to some grad school program.
Yeah, yeah.
So he spends 9 months of each year away from his family, and I just wonder if a lot of these early episodes, it's about trying to find ways to integrate Buster into this family dynamic in a consistent basis, because that's just not something he usually does.
Right. I wonder also if maybe like Tony Hale, the actor that played Buster, just had some other weird contract commitments and they probably were like, okay, let's write him. He went a bunch of places. And because I read that I saw it behind the scenes thing where they're talking about his audition and he literally just walked in. I don't know if Jason Bateman was there, and he just went, hey, brother, and he started, like, massaging him, and they immediately were like, yeah, that guy's got the role.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Like, that's all it took for them to go, okay, that's definitely – so maybe Tony Hale had some other contractual obligations, and they had to write him out certain things.
But they find ways to make it work because other shows, these sorts of problems happen in other shows, and I don't know – so I remember, for example, in Frasier, I don't remember the actor's name who plays Daphne. She had a baby and they wrote her out of the show for about 6 or 7 episodes. And
they just like one off mention it? They would be like, Daphne's gone.
So it was after Niles and Daphne professed their love for one another. And then she became a binge eater and gained a lot of weight. And she went to this is awful. She went to a weight loss camp and
whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. So she was gone for 6 or 7 episodes at this weight loss camp. And then she came back and she was petite and sinewy. And it was.
That's not too good, Frasier.
No, it was really awkward. But they did it because she was pregnant. So that's how they explained her weight gain.
Yeah, but here it's like it feels very organic.
And no, that's my point. Yeah, it feels completely organic here, and I really, really like, even though I love Buster, I like not having him in this episode.
I didn't miss him. I always miss him, but I didn't miss him at the same time.
Yeah. Right.
I have Lucille's amazing racism. I don't know why I wrote that. I'm sure it's something to do with the housekeeper.
So there are so many awful housekeeping jokes in these early episodes. I was watching one last night where she says something to the effect, "This is not a hardware store."
Oh, Jesus.
I suppose the worst part about Lucille's racism, she doesn't think she's being funny, right? So there are really pernicious, not so subtle forms of racism today where someone thinks they're being edgy and they know they're being racist. This is just how Lucille sees the world. Yeah, she seems genuinely offended that Michael would challenge her when she asks to search her maid's handbag before she leaves. Like, well, what else would I do? They're immigrants. They'll steal our stuff, Michael. Don't you know this? Are you an idiot or something? And just her, she's so incredulous in moments like that. She doesn't understand or she's skeptical of anyone in her family who challenges her racism. So you're right. That's just another way of making her an awful, awful character.
But do you think that it, this sounds so bad, but I don't dislike her because of it. I think it adds to her character for all. That so, makes me terrible.
No,
I know.
No, I don't think so. What do you think it adds to her character?
I think she is this very sharp. If I had to like, she reminds me of like a very sharp, like ad man from like the 60s, like a Mad Men style.
Okay.
Don Draper, only not as brooding. She's more like Sterling, basically.
Okay.
As a woman in the present day. And okay. She just says whatever the hell she wants off the top of her head. And I kind of love her for it. I don't know why. I mean, she's just I don't think she's villainous. I think she has a really good heart, but also think she's very tough. And she doesn't have a censor. I don't think she needs one.
Like Job, there is a sense of entitlement to this character. And this is a show.
I don't feel that, but go ahead.
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow, my goodness. She, so much of all of this feels like entitlement to me. And when I'm thinking about this family and the way I bifurcate them, so there's Michael and George Michael on one side, and then there's everyone else on the other side.
Sure.
And I don't necessarily know if Tobias and Buster fit into these categories, but Lindsay, Job, Lucille, they just feel so entitled. And there's something really funny because the show, again, is clearly not endorsing their entitlement. It's criticizing it. And the joke, I suppose, is they don't realize just how entitled. So anytime Job, for example, talks about these injustices that are perpetrated against him, mm-hmm. he fails to recognize just how entitled he is and just how fortunate he is. And Lucille's the same way, right?
I guess to me, I would see Lucille being this kind of person, even if she was in a family that was like of poor farmers.
Really?
Like,
okay.
I still feel like she would be this very no nonsense type of human being. And okay. I maybe she would have a sense of entitlement, but I don't think it would change her personality at all.
Well, I wonder if her entitlement is relative, though. So within if her family was poor, she would still feel entitled to certain things that members of her family shouldn't have because of this arbitrary thing. Right.
She reminds me a lot of like, when Scarlett O'Hara makes that turn to psychotic, she reminds me of like psychotic Scarlett O'Hara.
Okay.
Even though I hate Gone with the Wind, that's what she reminds me of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still curious, because correct me if I'm wrong, you like Lucille or
I love Lucille.
Okay. Do you love her because you think she's amusing, or do you love her because she's so oblivious? Because she's not always oblivious. So I wonder how much of this is her fabricating a certain demeanor and just being completely unwilling to let that facade fall. Because Job doesn't seem to understand anything that's happening.
No.
But Lucille,
he's an idiot.
Lucille doesn't seem like an idiot. She has these moments where you're right, she can be a genuine human being. So I wonder if this is just a very convincing act that allows her to get what she wants.
And I can agree with that, but I don't know if she like I think she always cares for her family, but she shows it in different ways to different people. She definitely loves Michael, and you can see that. There are moments between them that feels real.
Right.
But for the most part, I think she's just this perfect, like, caricature of a she reminds me of, like, this 1960s businessman. That's what she reminds me of. In all ways. And I don't think it's like, a facade. I think that's just Lucille. She's just that person.
Right.
And sometimes she's goofy and she lets loose, and I think that's great. But I don't think she's ever putting on an act. I mean,
really?
I think she's always just Lucille.
Okay.
And opposed to, like, I think Lindsay and Tobias and Joe definitely put on an act just trying to get through everyday life.
Right.
But Lucille, I think, is just very much this person.
That's interesting. Yeah. Okay,
I never thought I would go this deep with fucking Arrested Development.
No, I don't know if I would disagree with you, especially based on only two episodes, but okay, so her interactions with Lindsay, we get a sense of what their relationship is like in this episode, and it's incredibly antagonistic. And she criticizes Lindsay in ways because she's constantly focusing on Lindsay's appearance. And
yes.
I don't know if she's doing that because she loves her daughter. That's fucked up. I
think that she I think maybe she's jealous of her daughter because we definitely know that George Sr. later, we find this out, really loves Lindsay. And when Lindsay was growing up, treated Lindsay like a goddess, basically.
Right.
So there could be that sense of jealousy over them.
Okay.
And now Lucille can just fire on all cylinders and let her have it.
Well, but also, so Lucille, and this is regrettably undeniable, Lucille is much, much older. And it's abundantly clear that Jessica Walters is and was a beautiful, beautiful woman.
Yeah.
But if I'm thinking about how she must feel in relation to this young, incredibly attractive woman who happens to be her daughter, and she is just not that. And there's so many jokes about her neck, for example, and how the best, and this is much later, but the best use of any Bluth money was when George Sr. paid to have her neck fixed.
Yes.
So I think you're right. I think the jealousy and the antagonism, because Lindsay embodies what Lucille was at one point.
Because I don't imagine Lucille saying those things to some lady she doesn't know. But I think because Lindsay's her daughter, she can just say, I'm just going to say fuck you and say what I want to say.
Well, but she makes all those awful jokes to Lucille too later about her vertigo.
Well, let's be honest about Lucille too. Lucille too is oblivious to everything except for one moment. We'll get to Lucille too way later.
Way later.
I love as a character, by the way. She's awesome.
I think that's really nice because it helps me understand why she treats Michael the way she does, because that seems to imply that she might look at Michael as a kindred spirit, someone who's a lot like her, very smart, very intuitive,
sharp,
very intelligent.
Yeah.
And Michael, because Lindsay tries with Lucille, so they had this wonderful bit of verbal sparring where Lucille said, now wait for that flame to subside before you just dunk your head in it.
Yeah.
And then Lindsay says something to the effect of, well, I was about to tell you to lean back because you're soaked in alcohol. And then Lucille said, mine was better. And I don't necessarily know if she ever feels that way with Michael, that she's gotten the better of the exchange with Michael because he's so smart and he's so fast and he's so intelligent and intuitive.
And she's aware of that. I even think at the beginning, I think in the pilot, she knows that she's going to be partner over Michael. I really feel that way, too.
Okay. You think so? That's awful, though, because so she says things like,
that's just her. That's who she is.
Dad's making a big
deal. I mean, we know like by the end of season three, this is way down the line, that she is like the mastermind of everything.
We'll get to that because I have problems with that.
But anyway, like that's what I'm saying. Like from day one, Lucille knows what's up, but she also never, I don't think she ever. When she lies to Michael about talking to Joe on the phone, that's just her. That's just her character would be like, I'm just going to tell the dumbest things I can.
But she's so bad at lying.
But she would know Michael's going to know this anyway.
Oh, so what you're implying is she lies, but she knows that Michael knows.
Of course.
That it's not actually Joe.
Yeah, because like the big lies, she gets away with those.
That's really interesting, John. I had never thought of it that way. That these moments when these moments when Michael catches her in a lie, she perhaps intends for Michael to catch her in these lies.
Yeah, of course.
That's really interesting.
Because anybody could
catch
her. You
are turning Lucille into a supervillain at this point. She is.
But she does it so perfectly. Okay. But she's got a big heart for some weird reason.
I think you're – well, just with Michael, though, it seems.
And I think George Michael. I also think – obviously Buster, which we'll get to in the second season.
But that's really fucked up.
Their relationship is a little fucked up, but obviously she loves him a lot.
I don't know. We'll get there. We'll get there. Can we talk about Job's anxiety about being the oldest son and the responsibility associated with it? Because so in this episode, Job is upset that Michael isn't including him in the business.
Job is upset. You could stop there. Every episode.
He's upset about something. But he's upset because Michael isn't including him in the business.
Yeah.
And then when Michael includes him, he is upset because he's not given enough responsibility.
Right.
But he can't even do the simple thing Michael wants him to do. And we're told in an act of defiance, he attempts at least to hurl the letter into the ocean.
Yeah, Michael wants him to mail a letter. That's all he wants him to do.
That's it.
And Job immediately comes back with, can't you just take that to a post office or something?
And then Michael says, I can't trust a postman with this.
And he was being sincere.
I think so.
We find out that Michael was being sincere.
Right.
And it shows Job at the beach just trying to hurl this letter into the ocean. It's so fucking perfect.
It's just his ineptitude. It's so, God, doesn't he shout... Go back from whence you came. Yes. Or is that later with
the
rabbit?
That's with the dove.
That's with the dove. That's so weird.
When he throws the dove in, the rabbit just drops. Which is also one of the best things.
But because Job, what does Job want? This is what I want to understand. I want to understand, and maybe we haven't watched enough episodes, what does Job actually want?
I don't know. I mean, I he's definitely given later, he's definitely given the charade of running the business almost into the ground in a day, but
those suits.
Come on. But I don't know what he wants. I think he wants his dad. Obviously, he wants his dad to love him. That's a big deal. He wants his family to respect him. Maybe he wants Michael's respect.
Maybe.
And Michael does try to. And I think Michael, just by saying, could you mail this for me, does try to give him that respect. But Job just sees it as like, you treat me like an idiot.
He's basically like
Job is Lenny from Of Mice and Men.
Okay. Oh my God.
And that's his character. I feel like that's definitely his character.
Okay. Okay. So that would make Michael George.
Yeah, Michael would definitely be George.
So many Georges now that we mentioned.
Oh wow, you're right.
But there is something. There is something patronizing about asking him to mail a letter, right?
Yeah, but I think in the way he does it, there definitely is. But he meant it sincerely. He really didn't mean, I need you to mail this letter.
Okay.
I guess.
I don't know. I think because Michael.
Do you think he's just being an asshole?
I think he is. I think Michael.
I don't want to believe that.
The way he says, I can't trust a mailman with this.
That's what I would say
to a child. Would you take that to the kitchen for me? Can't you do it? I can't trust myself.
No.
You take that tone and that posture. I just don't. It feels like he's interacting with a child.
It is asshole-y. I agree. But I do think for whatever reason today when I watched this morning, I thought it was sincerity. I don't know why. Maybe that's just the mode I'm in right now.
Maybe. Clearly Michael's trying. If he really didn't care,
right,
he would do nothing.
Yeah.
And he would let Job think whatever he wanted to think.
In this he should have done nothing.
He definitely should have done nothing. If this episode establishes anything, never let Job do anything. But back to my original question, I think you're right. Job wants to be respected and loved, but he is unable to acknowledge that sometimes respect is the product of working hard and being successful.
Yeah.
And that love maybe at times needs to be earned and shouldn't just be given. Now, I think it's probably different with parents and children, but I think with respect, especially because he talks about on the beach how he always feels like he's the joker or the goofball. Mm-hmm. but he fails to acknowledge that he puts himself in that position. So he wants to do the things he wants to do, but he doesn't want the reputation or the consequences associated with doing those things.
Do you think, I mean, again, I guess that goes back to the entitlement thing.
Yeah, he's
just
so
wants
entitled.
The respect without doing anything.
Yeah, he's so entitled. If he's like every oblivious, entitled white male.
Okay, so then that brings up this question. Why didn't Michael get that? If everybody else in the family has it, not Buster. Buster's aloof and ridiculously childlike. So, but why did Michael not get that? Do you think that from day one he just bred to be like George Sr. and Lucille said, we have fucked up these other two, so let's try to focus on Michael.
Yeah, I get the sense, so, and this is later, but there's this moment in prison when I think George Sr. has asked Job to do something illegal for nefarious reasons, and a comment is made about Michael, and Lucille and George Sr., they have this genuine tender moment where they say, yeah, we did something right there. And they're holding hands when they say it. I just get the impression that they didn't have a plan, and Michael was simply predisposed to certain tendencies and characteristics, and they just, I think they just got lucky with Michael.
I mean, even in this episode, though, we see that George Sr. threw him in the banana stand and made him work there,
right,
like a slave, basically.
Right.
And later we see him, like, not take him on a camping trip. We see him not do all these things.
Okay.
And I wonder if that is, like, I wonder if that is George, like, you know, shaping him to be the good one.
I don't know, because
the
after
one with, like,
hearing
ethic.
You, after hearing you say that, now I think maybe all of this is just a coping mechanism for Michael. So, maybe. George Sr. throws him in the banana stand, and it's horrible, and it's depressing, and it's arduous, and Michael could become resentful, or he could say, no, this is what makes a person good. They find value in working
and he
very
does
hard.
That. And he does that
throughout the show, and that's the ethical principle he's teaching his son as well. My goodness, that is really fucked up. Now I'm beginning to think Michael has been just as traumatized as the rest of them.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But Michael realizes it and realizes that we talked about in the pilot, you know, like Michael loves family and is for his family, obviously. But they're all fucked in the head, but he still is like, okay, I'm going to try to make this all work. And even growing up in that situation, could you imagine that household? When
no,
you're the
I can't.
One trying to be serious the whole time.
Like, I know.
You're trying to have worth and value and ethic, and no one else in your family does. And now he's grown up and he's like, because there comes a point when as a child, you feel like you have to take care of your parents. I don't
sure.
have siblings, but I'm sure there comes a moment then when you have to be like, they need help and I have to help them. And Michael, I think, has been doing that his whole life.
Wow.
And he just can't get away from it.
That's awful.
He's like reeled in constantly to help these horrible people.
Well, that's what happens in episode one. And we talked about this.
Yeah.
It appears as though we're seeing Michael at the very end of a long, long trajectory where he's been really patient and really sympathetic toward his family.
Mm-hmm.
And he just can't do it anymore. But he seems to force himself to do it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I really feel a lot of sympathy for Michael, because I think this is what has happened to you is awful.
Yeah. And I think he definitely just treats George Michael how he was treated.
OK, so let's talk about George Michael, because we see a lot of George Michael anxiety in this episode.
A lot. And it's funny.
It's
Michael
funny.
Michael Cera, before Michael Cera became whatever he is now, was a very funny actor.
It's so, oh, my goodness. He's trying to burn the banana stand down. And
yeah, because of like a loss of who how much money do you think? $20 probably.
I'm thinking they lost $50.
Yeah, $50. Let's burn it down.
We don't know how much a Bluth frozen banana costs. I mean, even in this is actually a joke much, much later when Lucille says, like, how much is a banana? $10. And I said, like, I don't know how much bananas cost. But I mean, even if it's $100, right? Okay,
yeah.
So, but he's 14, 15?
Yeah.
that seems like a big deal, right? And he, you just spilled water on yourself.
It's dripping. It's condensation. Last time you spilled tea all over yourself.
I know.
I had a drop.
It's your turn this
Don't
time.
Don't let him fool you, podcast listeners.
But I wonder if George Michael feels a lot of this responsibility, and he thinks, okay, I've become the manager. This is the moment now when I can be like my dad. And he fucks it up the first time.
Right. But you also, I mean, we also like infer that Michael probably fucked up too when we see him in the banana stand covered in chocolate. Like, that's just, you know, that's just how it goes.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. And he just, instead of, his whole family always panics. And that would be something any person in his family would do to get out of a loss of $50. Well, let's just fucking burn it down.
I know.
Like, come on. I mean, that's what they go with, is instead of let's just try to make up the money. Let's, you know, we'll take this as a loss. No, let's just set it on fire.
Well, it's quick.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah. And it's very, very drastic.
It is.
But here's another thought I had. Let's go back to Michael for just a second.
Okay.
If Michael, we should have talked about this last week, but we didn't. If Michael had become the director of the Bluth Company, would he turn into George Sr.?
I don't know.
Because do you think George Sr. is obviously protecting him. When he says, you know, the time wasn't right, he obviously knows that shit's going to go wrong right now.
Sure.
So he is protecting him. Again, we see that he loves Michael.
Sure.
But also, do you think that he fears that Michael will become this thing, like this awful thing?
I don't know if George, because George Sr. vacillates a lot. He doesn't seem to know himself at all.
Yeah.
So he's really hesitant and really tentative, because at times he seems to acknowledge all of the awful things he's done, but then at other times he's just charmingly oblivious, and he thinks he's like Job in this respect. He believes that some grand injustice has been perpetrated against him. So I don't know if George Sr. has that kind of awareness to actually believe that he is wrong or bad, or that there's something so terribly unethical about him that he wouldn't want his son to become like him. So you think he actually does?
Yeah.
No. Okay. Well, talk about, so he knows there's something bad, wrong, and awful about him, and he's trying to keep his son from...
Because George Sr. does have moments of being smart, and he does have moments of being slick and sly. And I think from the pilot, you know, we infer that George Sr. loves Michael and doesn't want to see him go down this path. I don't think so.
Okay.
It's almost like that Don Corleone, Michael Corleone.
I was about to say, you're turning Arrested Development into the Godfather.
I really am. But that's what it's like, basically. Like, you know, when Don Corleone says, I never wanted this life for you, George Sr., I feel like, is almost in that same boat. Like, look at the piece of shit I've become with all these people. Your family is terrible, and there's a strong chance that maybe corruption will find you if you get here. That could totally be a thing.
You're not wrong.
Like, Michael has the company, but he's got to keep it afloat. He doesn't have time to be corrupted by anything. He's just got to, like, figure out how to keep the thing from sinking.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong. And I think it's interesting. So this is something we can think about as we continue watching and talking about it. Because Michael does commit in future episodes small indiscretions and small...
Very small.
Very, very small. But I suppose, considering what you're arguing, I don't know if one becomes a criminal mastermind by just deciding one day to do a terrible thing. In most of these stories, it's one small indiscretion leads to a slightly larger indiscretion, leads to a slightly larger indiscretion. And I get the sense with someone like George Sr. that's maybe what it always was. Or he could have just been a complete asshole.
Well, I think he has been. We see later that in flashbacks, he was just a complete asshole.
Yeah, but I wonder if we were to fill in the gaps and the spaces between those, would we see one small indiscretion led to a slightly larger indiscretion? Because I think that's what we're led to believe about someone like Vito Corleone, right?
So
it started really small for him, and then it just ballooned into this big, awful thing.
Sure.
But yeah, with George, I don't, because I never actually believe George has a plan, I guess. I'm so, they seem so illogical and so incapable of conceptual thought, I wonder if they're just reacting to things. And
yeah,
then, oh my God, what has happened to my life? I never intended for this to happen, but they also have no ability to mark or track the things they do and to see these larger connections that could possibly be inferred from all of the bad things right. they've done.
Anyway, we're getting close to the end of the episode, so let's talk
about
we got really deep in the philosophy
of
Michael.
Well, I think the show invites that.
Sure,
though.
Sure.
Because a show like this, even though it is trying to be funny and it is remarkably funny, it wouldn't give us these moments where characters talk about how their relationships with their family members affect them if maybe the show wasn't inviting us to think about them in these terms.
So let's talk about the banana stand.
Okay.
Who gets the banana stand award for being the craziest Bluth this episode? My award for the banana stand goes to the one and only Tobias.
Oh! That's not what I said, but go ahead. Explain.
Tobias is constantly in this episode being a complete just nut job, from crying in the shower while biting a washcloth to screaming at the fire sale to reading a tractor pull magazine instead of an actual actor pull magazine. Well, he even thought that there would be a magazine called Actor Pull.
Now I think I want you and us to create an industry publication called Actor Pull.
Actor Pull. I think Tobias is genuinely insane.
Okay.
What do you got?
George Michael.
This is a close second for me.
We've talked about it already, so I won't belabor the point, but his instinct to burn the banana stand to the ground because he may have lost a couple of $100s is completely insane.
Very, very Bluthian.
Well, that's what I mean. Because last week we talked about how, is there any way to keep someone from being a Bluth? Is there any way to condition someone to not indulge these Bluthian instincts? And I don't know if there is.
Well, Tobias isn't necessarily a Bluth, but I think being married to Lindsay, he is just kind of became one, basically.
I don't know. It's a.
But yeah, you're right. George Michael is insane in this episode.
He's completely insane, and the things he wants to do, completely insane. We missed a couple of funny segue jokes, by the way. Now that we're here and talking about the banana stand getting burned to the ground, when all three Bluth men are standing and experiencing the catharsis that is the banana stand burning to the ground, which isn't really a catharsis for Job, because we're never led to believe he's worked in the banana stand. So again, Job is feeling something that he has no reason to feel whatsoever, but he feels entitled to feel that thing.
Yeah.
And Michael says, "You mailed the insurance check, right, Job?" And Job just slowly backs out of the seat. That's such just a great segue out. Joke.
That's awesome.
God, I love that segue joke so much. And then Michael's chasing him on the sex. Because
it's great.
Segways are not that fast. I think you could run faster than a segue.
Probably.
So I don't know what Job is trying to do, because I don't think he thinks he can get away.
He thinks he has wheels.
I know.
Or that should win.
Or it has a motor. So great segue joke. Also, new T-Bone, which we haven't talked about.
Yeah, Patrice O'Neill.
Patrice O'Neill
played T-Bone in this, and he's very funny.
He's very, very
funny.
He's
a flamer, quote unquote. And the whole time you don't know if that means if he's like super homosexual or if he is an arsonist. Turns out he's an arsonist.
He's an arsonist. Yeah, I really like that joke.
It's awesome.
It's such a great joke. John, favorite lines?
Okay, so definitely there was $250,000 lining the walls. That's why there's always money in the banana stand. And then he starts choking Michael, and you hear the no touching, and they have the back and forth. That's one of my favorite little bits. Ass to ankles, whenever Tobias and all of them are in the car together.
How have we not talked about this? That's my favorite Tobias line. We are just ass to ankles.
We are just ass to ankles back here.
I want to believe that was not in the script and that was a David Cross.
It probably was.
I am convinced that David Cross may have created on the set 40 to 60% of Tobias's lines.
Yeah, he's awesome. Oh, when Michael, we hear the narrator say, Michael still had to do some detective work after the storage unit's been burned down. And he walks directly over to T-Bone and goes, "You burn down the storage unit?" T-Bone goes, "Almost definitely." That's one of my favorite lines. When Lucille is trying to get Job a job, when she's like, "Give Job something to do," to Michael, and she goes, she goes, "He's very special." And Michael goes, "He's not special, mother." And she goes, "No." That's awesome. Doing the Time of My Life is also a classic.
Say it again.
When Michael says, "You're doing time," and George Sr. says, "I'm doing the time of my life.
Yeah, that's a great callback too.
Those are my favorite. Yeah.
Okay. I have a lot of those. No touching. I love no touching. And that's also a callback because we hear no touching, it seems, in almost every episode. Yes. Almost definitely. God, that's such an amazing reading of that line, but that's such a wonderful bit of comedy because, again, we're told by the narrator that Michael wants to do a bit of detective work.
Yeah.
But he's not doing detective work at all. It's so great. Is there a carbon monoxide leak in this house? I love that joke. That's when Michael finally realizes that Job, Lindsay, Tobias, and maybe are all just sitting in the living room, and he asks, to no one in particular, "Is there a carbon monoxide leak in this house?" Which is great. Yes. And I mentioned one already. In this business of show, you must have the heart of an angel and the hide of an elephant. I love that so much. That, and then he does the excuse me, and he does a little shimmy, and it's...
Excuse? He does the... the Steve Martin, excuse me, is that what it is?
That's what it is.
Excuse me.
And it's
excuse me.
it's great. You talked about mise-en-scene last time. It cuts to Michael and you can actually see Tobias walking up the stairs, is, God, I love that so much. I love that kind of detail. So amazing. Callbacks. So no touching.
Yes.
Lucille and Lindsay fighting while eating and drinking. This seems to happen a lot. Yep. They seem to always fight when they're eating and drinking.
Oh, they did fight a little bit in the first episode. I forgot about
that. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. The destruction of the banana stand. This actually happens a couple of times. Apparently, we learn maybe in season two, it's a yearly ritual. Or maybe it's season one, they rebuild the banana stand every year because kids burn it to the ground or terrorize it or vandalize it or something. I forgot this one, Time of My Life. You're absolutely right. That's a callback.
Mm-hmm.
Any else? Did we forget
anything? I don't think so.
Well, Job feeling entitled, you might say, is
that's everybody.
That's
all the
true.
Time.
That's true.
Yeah, I think that's it. There I was no. I was too. Hoping there was a Lucille wink in this, but there's not.
Nope, there's no wink.
Yeah, I also thought that this was the debut of Gene Parmesan.
Nope.
But I can't wait for Gene Parmesan to show up. He's one of my favorite characters.
So. If I recall correctly, doesn't he pop up in a lot of Christopher Guest movies? Or am I thinking of someone different?
Maybe he's in some. I don't. Yeah, he is. He is.
Is he? Because I thought I knew his
face. I can't remember his name, but he's so funny.
God, he's so.
But I thought he was there like for the fire thing, but that's later.
That's later.
So yeah, I really like this episode.
There's a wonderful joke with. Because Michael does detective work two times in this episode, there's a wonderful joke with Lucille's housekeeper taking all of her coats to the storage unit.
Yeah.
And Michael arrives and it's burnt to the ground and you can actually see her in the background. She gets
back on the bus.
She gets off the bus and then she looks and it's this amazing bit of physical humor. She throws her hands in the air and starts smacking the bus and you can actually hear her screaming. It's such a great joke. I love the way, because you talked about this last week, the way the Russos, and only one of them directed this episode, but just the way they create humor, not by having anyone say anything, but just by what they choose to show us and when they choose to show it to us. God, I love watching her beat against that bus in the background. It's such a funny way to
Yeah, I think the camera is such a great character in its own right.
I do too. I do too. Well, that is episode 2.
Yeah, it was great.
It is great.
It's a great episode.
It is great. We'll be back next time with episode 3. I didn't write down the name, so
it's called Buster's Day Out, maybe?
Bringing Up Buster?
Bringing Up Buster.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah.
I got Baby's Day Out and Bringing Up Baby. They're both baby movies.
Well, so relevant to this character, though.
Absolutely. Yeah. So,
for the Hop-Ons podcast, my name is Colin Cox.
I'm John Phelps.
Awesome. See you next time.
Thanks.
The Hop-Ons podcast is a Nice Marmot production with help from the Cluttered Desk podcast and music by Test Dream.
All of our contact information is in the show notes. The easiest way to contact us is through Twitter at Hop-Ons Podcast and email hoponspod@gmail.com.